I'm opening?
We have
an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity.
Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro, this is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Here we go, folks.
Nice.
So are we just going to talk about the trailer?
I think we're just listening.
This is American Hustle, as directed by David O. Russell. We're listening to what was the song in the teaser trailer.
Correct.
Which is what got me hooked to this movie.
It was a great trailer.
Almost a year ago?
Yeah. With the way that they release trailers? Yeah. Yeah, I would say a year, year and a half, 5 years ago.
And now the movie's finally, well, for us, out.
Correct.
In select cities, out nationwide December 20th. But here we are discussing it. I am your host, Phil Svitek. Joined alongside.
Hello, everybody. I'm Sarah Stretton.
Hello, everybody. It's Dimitri Panos.
And I do want to give a disclaimer at the top because, I was very much looking forward to seeing this movie. Unfortunately for me, it didn't quite live up to the hype. That will not, don't worry, this will not be an hour and a half tirade of me hating the movie. I will dissect it from a filmmaker perspective, as I know Sarah will.
Yes, because I'm going to try and focus on, what I really thought was good about this movie. Maybe it was because it was so built up for me that I went away not shouting from the rooftops that I love it. There are some things that I do love and some things that missed a mark in my book.
But
it is a good movie. I will give it. It's a good movie.
And Dimitri, you loved it.
I thought you were going to open up by saying, when you said I have to preface this by saying some of these events actually happened.
But all of these events are happening. Yes, they are.
Yeah. And yes, I did love this movie. It was when I was, from the first 10 minutes, I was pulled in. By the end of this movie, I saw it again. I've never really done that, even with a Star Trek movie. I've seen Star Trek movies twice within one day, but never back to back.
Interesting.
So in this movie, the opportunity just arose, and I went with it. So let's just say
Sunday. You said that this
Sunday,
is one of your top.
This makes my top three.
Of this year or just ever?
Of this year.
Okay.
Yeah, not ever, but of this year, absolutely.
Okay, I mean, and for me, I was really much looking forward to this. I mean, hearing the fact that it's a David O. Russell movie, I love Christian Bale. Bradley Cooper's been doing amazing work. Who doesn't love Jennifer Lawrence? Amy Adam. You can gush over. Yes. Jeremy Renner. Everything for me, it was just the perfect equation. And, I was looking forward to it because of The Fighter and because of Silverlining's playbook last year. I thought this would be the perfect storm for a movie. Although going to the writing, I think initially it failed in the sense that, given the backstory of it.
Sure.
First off, as you mentioned, some events, did happen, right? So just by putting that right up the front allows you creative freedom within it as long as some events happened, right? Or there's that notion. So this script initially was written, years ago by Eric Warren. Right.
Mm-hmm. Eric Warren Singer is his name, or Sanger, or that thing?
Yeah, he's credited that as such in the movie, yeah.
Yeah.
And it took a long time to kind of really get it there and be picked up.
And supposedly it was blacklisted, correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
But it was originally called American Bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Was the original title.
That would have been a good title.
Yeah. That was the original title. That was his original thing, so, yeah.
It was originally supposed to be directed by Ben Affleck. And in kind of seeing it, it almost in some ways it felt kind of like Argo. I mean, I think there's a thing with it where it's just too close to Argo. In terms of timing.
Oh,
timing.
Timing, theme. I mean, Argo was 70s. This was pure 70s. And yeah, absolutely. The timing was, yeah. I'm wondering how many years apart the events of Argo, which is way more true to life and story, than
let's see here.
And they mention Abscam. American Hustle historically takes place within Abscam, you know, which has that as its backdrop and part of, you know.
Which is 1978 to 1980.
Right. And then Argo, I think, might have. No, Argo had to be around the same time because they were Star Wars. They were making a science fiction movie. So I'm guessing it was about 77. Yeah, so you're right. Yeah.
See?
I think so your timing's right.
You know, and so obviously, you know, just right off the bat, let me theoretical question. How would you guys feel had Ben Affleck directed this movie?
I think I can't answer that question because he didn't.
Fair enough. I mean,
well, like, I don't know if that's why I'm.
Do you think there would be a backlash if, like, you just made two very similar movies?
I think there would have been comparison, but I also think that Ben Affleck would have made American Bullshit more so than what we got from David O. Russell.
Well,
so I think that, you know, he would have made another 70s historical piece that would have been more historically accurate than what we got. So.
I mean, with this movie, I mean, it's very much it has all the elements of a David O. Russell movie. When he signed on to the project, you know, he rewrote it in where he basically made everyone caricatures of themselves. And obviously, knowing him, he made it more of an ensemble piece.
Sure.
So that, in terms of the writing, that's what David O. Russell brought to it.
But he did a page one rewrite. When the original script was given to Bale, and then David was getting his hands on it, Bale was like, "Whoa, what the F are you doing, man?" And like, because he did a page one rewrite, like just from the get go, and he came up with like 140-170 page script. So whatever Eric had done, he had completely rewritten. American Bullshit apparently was very procedural, which is why I think they were interested in getting Ben Affleck. After you see a movie like Argo and what he did, you know, Argo to an extent is very procedural, you know, and how it goes. And David O. Russell said, you know what, this isn't my kind of a movie. I want it to be more about characters. And I want it to be about characters, about reinvention, about, I don't want to say rejuvenation, but about, you know, making one better, like, oh, and actually transformation. And, so he just rewrote completely, like, whatever is left of the original screenplay. It's very little.
What did Christian Bale? You said that Christian Bale was totally. What was his reaction?
Like, what the fuck? He goes,
"What
are you doing?"
In a good way or a bad way?
He didn't know. He was like, "What are you doing?" And so basically, what David O. Russell did was he actually went to each of the main actresses' houses and such, and he basically said, "Okay, this is what I want the character to be. What do you think about this? What do you think about this character?" And he allowed people like Christian Bale and Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Adams to flesh out their characters. It would go, "Oh, okay, that's great. Oh my God, that's great." And they would talk about it, and then he would go in and he would write that, put that into the script, and then he put his quote unquote his love triangle, so to speak, in there, and he made a movie about redemption, because that's another theme. He actually sort of kind of likened this to when you look at Silver Linings, The Fighter in this movie, he says thematically it's a trilogy for him because each movie has a story of someone who's reinventing themselves, someone who's seeking redemption to do better. And he says this is what he wanted to do. And he wanted to make it a love story as well. And those are the things that to David O. Russell in this point in his life is very important to him. And he felt that with American Bullshit, that it was a little bit cynical and procedural. And he says, that's just not my style. So it's actually sort of kind of amazing that he was allowed to take somebody's screenplay, who worked hard at it. He gets credit, but he just rewrote it. And he didn't make it like historically accurate. He didn't want that so much. I mean, he changed the people's names. He added these characters. And Christian Bale is like, you know, he thought it was a good script. And he's like, "Well, what are you doing?" And ultimately, Christian Bale is like, "I've worked with him. I trust him. okay, let's work this out. And, you know, for me, they worked out like some American cinematic magic.
I mean, you know, and maybe there's a question for Sarah, slightly hypothetical if I ask you. In whenever an actor, for me, that, you know, it's interesting that he trusts, David O. Russell trusts his actors enough to get their opinion, because obviously, you know, the worry would be if you ask an actor of like, hey, what should your character be? Well, anything that gets me more pages. You know, that would be my worry versus like, you know, but I think the greats, and you know, all of these actors we mentioned are great.
Yeah.
I think they know, okay, you know what, create the best product over whatever gets me more pages.
Yeah, but what about like if somebody who is writing something and they had this project, yeah, well, if they approached you and they said, hey, I want to sit down, I want to hash out your character more. What do you think this character is? Like, how would you feel about that?
I guess
that?
I think that happens all the time. That's not unusual, I guess, if maybe for film, but like that's pretty much how plays and character development works.
Yeah, but the plays are already written.
Yeah, but you fill in a bunch of stuff. So if someone comes up to you and like asks you about it, you can talk about it, not expecting to get any more or any less. If someone tells you a little bit about this person, it's the same as like every actor when you get sides for an audition or something. You only get so much about a character and you kind of have to make up the rest unless you're told. So if someone came in and asked you what you thought about it and what you created, you should have that based off the little they get you. Then they can adjust it and tweak it and be like, actually, think about something this way or add in this factor or the fact that they're a single mom or anything. So to me, it's not that weird of a situation. It's a collaborative process that seems like how they made this movie in between how he did approach the actors and get their positions. But I think it's because he had very talented people who can create lives off tiny segments of information.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's that out of this world or anything. I think that
I think it happens less than you would think. You know, it happens with the really good ones and when you can really trust and you have developed, as he has, a trust with all of these actors.
And the way I was to understand it, he actually, when he was doing his rewrites, he actually said, okay, so I have this character. How do you think? Like, to me, like within the script process, you know, you write a script. Boom, here's my script. It gets picked up. It's going to be made into a movie. And the director or producer or somebody might come up to the actor, actress, or come up to you and say, okay, this is your character. This is who, you know, you audition for this character. And then maybe as the movie goes along, you know, there are always rewrites being done, you know, and actor, actress could bring their thoughts, their feelings to it as it's being done.
Yeah.
But it's rare that it happens before. It's rare that
true, and that's just because these people had all worked together before and knew each other. And
but in a sense, they, like Jennifer Lawrence, had never, like they were all from separate things. Like Bradley Cooper wasn't in The Fighter, whereas
true.
You know, and so they hadn't really. Some of them had worked together in certain sense, but they like I just said, like Christian Bale never worked with
Jennifer Lawrence.
But Jennifer Lawrence and Christian Bale weren't sitting there creating characters and creating a story. They were working with their director, so you only really needed that person to be connected to everyone beforehand. And I mean, I don't know, I think that did work in some ways, because I felt like there was a lot of expectations put on these people, especially after Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence were nominated last year and got awards, and everyone says like, you need to like make sure you keep your next movie or your next drama is really gonna, you have to prove that you deserved it or whatnot.
Right.
And I don't think in any way the acting hurt any of their careers. I think they all did a really good job. They fleshed it out. For me, this is going to be one of my problems. That role was written for Jennifer Lawrence. He says that. He said he envisioned her from the beginning. And to me, I love her. I think she does a phenomenal job. I think that her scenes are great. But I honestly felt that as a person, she was too young for this role. It stuck out to me the whole time that she wasn't anywhere near the same age group as the rest of them. And to me, it also, Amy Adams was great and looked beautiful, but it made Amy Adams look really old. And in certain instances, I felt like Amy Adams was playing almost like her mother instead of the mistress to this woman. And it was something that pulled me out almost every time because I was like,
well, it certainly defies a convention because you would think
like
if you're going to
9 year old kid,
if you're going to cheat on anybody, you know, you would be with Amy Adams cheating with on her with Jennifer Lawrence because she's the, you know, the young one.
The young one.
It just pulled me out of like a belief and like I loved her for like the talent and she really gave so much to the role. And it's not to say that. It's just that in the casting, I was like, I would have picked someone older. Or like for me, this could have been a play and she could have played it because you could kind of mess with age more on stage. But in film where people are so used to accuracy and like, I don't know, things being real when it comes to like age or looks or type or whatever, to me, she stuck out every time.
And I'll counter that with a couple of things. A, what I've always found great about Jennifer Lawrence as an actress, especially after watching the Silver Linings Playbook, is I'm always more astounded as to how young she actually is. I think as an actress, she's well beyond her years as an actress. A, I think in this movie, again, I was like, she was amazing. And I'm like, she is so, at this point in her career, to me, she is so above like a Katniss Everdeen. Like she is a phenomenal actress that can get any role at this point in her career. And that she's just amazing to me every time I see her. The live and let die scene, I thought it was just awesome. The scenes that she had with Amy Adams, I thought was great. You know, it was a hard line for me. Like she was either dumb or really, really smart and manipulative. And to me, that was a fine line. The other thing is, I think because of her age and looking the way she did, it further puts forth that she's not meant for him. Like, however, she obviously had a kid while she was young. And I think that within the context of this story, because we know, as you see, or I at least gathered, Christian Bale's character with Amy Adams was the right fit, the right match. And that for whatever the purpose is, however Jennifer Lawrence's character and Christian Bale's character get together, it's not a right match. And that character, Christian Bale's character, in fact, has one of the great lines in the movie where he said, maybe she was just my karma for treating people so poorly, you know, before. Yeah. And I was like, I love that. So her age thing hit me at all.
It just pulled me out because on top of the fact that she has this kid who I can't tell how old he is, but she must have had him when she was like very, very young teenager. But then on top of this, you have that they had this whole history of how they got together and how he saved her. And then somehow, after he obviously had a loving relationship with her and adopted her son, and all this time passed between them, then he developed this whole new relationship with Sydney, and they had this whole life and this whole scheme in all these years, and then it fell down the toilet, and now they're in this situation. I'm like, where is that chunk of time in Jennifer Lawrence's age? It doesn't mathematically make sense, and I don't understand.
Yeah, but you don't know how old she is. I mean, they never give her age. You're just saying that she looks young, but you never know. They never give an age at all as to what she is, and if you wanted to, I mean, you could extrapolate from the kid looked like he was 7, 8, maybe. I don't know.
Exactly.
I don't know. But, and I also get the sense that he married her to save more the kid. He seemed to more love the kid, and he adopted the kid because, you know, that was his.
I do get that. Just to me, if he has such a history with her and such a history with Sydney, that takes time, and these relationships needed to go through their own cycles. And it didn't make, so that's why I didn't believe it, because I was just like, how did she spend all these years? Where are they? She's too young.
Yeah.
She did a great job. Like, they gave her a character and she embraced it and, like, full-heartedly did great acting. I'm not saying anything against her performance. I'm saying it should have been given to someone older, in my opinion.
Yeah, I disagree. I thought she nailed it for whatever age she was playing.
I mean, a lot of people would agree with Dimitri on this one. I side a little bit with Sarah, but I want to know this, going back to kind of the script level, but this does affect the actors, of course. Mm-hmm. Who are you supposed to root for in this movie? I ask because in Silver Linings Playbook, right, you know, you root for Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper. in The Fighter, you know, you're kind of following Mark Wahlberg's character more or less, and then everyone, it seems where everyone in those movies ends up well. In I Heart Huckabees, it's kind of, you know what I mean, it's a crazy journey, but you're kind of following not the couple, but the detectives.
Right. Let's keep I Heart Huckabees, like, let's tack it up, because I wanted to bring that up at some point during this, but I think you posed a great question.
Anyone? I initially was rooting for Bradley Cooper's character.
Maybe that's, okay. Interesting. Okay.
But it threw me off because, you know, again, just from the way it was told, and I don't know if this was on the script level or, it, you know, they brought it in post with the voiceover. You know, obviously we have like a 10-minute voiceover between Christian Bale and Amy Adams, right, of their kind of backstory and things like that. And they're essentially the bad guys. But even if, for me, even if you're supposed to root for them, there was nothing that Bradley Cooper's character did to me that was so offensive and wrong. Because morally, he was right, apart from, okay, beating up his boss. But I, you know,
but
whatever.
I think even more, well, this is great. And I think this is great discussion because, yeah, we should do a character breakdown and what you thought. But you first, because you have some thoughts, and then I'll get into who I think you're supposed to be following and quote unquote rooting for. But
okay, so this is both one of my problems with me and one of my biggest compliments. What I really loved is how that they really did change the typical expectation of who you are supposed to be rooting for and who you develop, like, I guess, feelings for in a way. Because you have your, how do I phrase this? You have your bad guys, your crooks, who you end up trying to understand, and I feel like they're trying to get you almost on their side and rooting for them by the end. Then you have Bradley Cooper, who's playing like your cop, and typically you're supposed to love the cop and side with the cop because he's going for justice, and they make you dislike him. And then you have all the politicians who they make you understand why they're going out of their way. They don't make them bad guys. I feel like they switched around who the typical villains are and who the typical heroes are, and they kind of muddled everything up, and I thought that's a good feat to, like, go against the stereotype of average film is wonderful.
But even, you know,
but like you said, the only thing I really stuck to was, like, okay, so I just want Christian Bale and Amy Adams to end up together.
Yeah,
because that's the only running through thing that I can find. Typically, so that's what I'm going to side with.
Typically, and I'll let you speak to Dimitri right after this, but you can typically, again, you can root for the, quote, the good guys, or the bad guys can become the good guys.
But they made the bad guys the good guys, and they made the good guys the bad guys.
But you can do that, but it needs to be very clear. I mean, I'm trying to think of a great example of how to do that.
I think they did do that.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts, Dimitri?
Well, my thoughts are it's a very interesting year as far as movies go and who you're going to follow. As I was watching American Hustle, I couldn't not think about Inside Llewyn Davis, because right now we'll have two movies out there in which your lead character isn't necessarily the good guy. But I think as far as American Hustle goes, you know, if you're going to break down archetypes, you know, who your good guys, your bad guys are, yes, the police should be the good guy. These are the con men, your politicians or whatever. But I think what David O. Russell does is he fashions this in such a way where, number one, it opens up with Christian Bale. Mm-hmm. You get his history, and his whole history is about he'd rather be the taker than the than being taken. He'd rather be the guy. And with his father was taken and stuff, and he didn't want to do that. So he began conning or scamming at a young age and doing whatnot. And then we meet Amy Adams, who is escaping. Again, you're looking at two people who are trying to escape a life that they had, and they created a whole new life to do this. And, you know, Amy Adams being one of them. So meeting at the beginning and how they met, they were actually, again, with every scene that I see with Christian Bale and Amy Adams, I see this a real budding true relationship and love going. And I think you're supposed to follow these characters because they're the ones who sort of kind of have the arc. By the end of the movie, they actually, look, they say, we gotta get out of this. We have to change. And at the end, they actually, they leave that behind and they become parents. They become the responsible adults. They get out of, they change for the better life. And I think with Christian Bale's character, I think it's seen throughout the entire movie that he specifically cons people. Like, he says, the people who are coming to me are the people who are not going to go to the banks because of legitimacy. Like, I'm conning people who are already, like, not good people. And you could also tell with his relationship with Polito, with Hurt Locker guy.
Jeremy Renner's
character.
I'm in the Avengers. What are you talking about?
When you have Carmine Polito by Jeremy, you know, he is a politician that has a good heart, but he's making decisions that he feels are for the betterment of the people.
And the audience doesn't think he's doing anything wrong.
Not necessarily, but he is. And Christian Bale has the heart. And when he says, "You're the best friend I've ever had," he's not lying. You could see in certain scenes, in one scene in particular, where Polito is with his cronies and he's going, "This guy Irving is going to save Jersey. He's going to do it. He's going to get the Sheik out here." And Christian Bale's like having a hard time looking him in the eye.
So are you rooting for Christian Bale the whole
Absolutely.
Time? Okay.
You are, because you're rooting for
him, or are you rooting for their relationship?
For both. I mean, you're rooting for both these people to come on, because to me, Bradley Cooper's character as Richie D'Amato or D'Amaso, he was a douche. The only thing he was looking for was limelight, power, but yet he was an 8-year-old. Like, he did it so childishly, and like, he never gave respect to his boss, and he was just a douche about it all. And he was never, when he gets his comeuppance, he gets exactly what he deserves.
And I think that's why also you like it so much, because from the very beginning, you knew who you were kind of siding with, versus like Phil. He was rooting for the guy who everyone ends up disliking. Therefore, you're going to be unhappy in a way. But what I want to say is, like, it's true. I was rooting for their relationship from the very beginning, and I wasn't seeing this as a con movie. I was seeing it as, okay, we've got people who are supposed to be together, who have been pulled apart, who are going to get back together. But then I also was like, halfway through, I knew the ending. So it allowed certain things to lag in certain points, because what was carrying me through was a love story in a mob movie.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure. Because I mean, in a sense it is. But to me, again, you're forgetting about the themes of redemption. Both of these people, they needed to reinvent themselves.
And they needed
a redemption. They needed to redeem themselves. They knew that what they were doing was not good. They got caught at it.
And see, I liked them. I didn't need as much redemption. And I also knew it was coming so much that I was kind of...
Yeah, and I didn't know that it was coming, because when they're putting this thing together, like, there are a couple of scenes. And, there's that... They're together, they're apart, and then they slowly start to get back together again, where Christian Bale's character sort of has the epiphany, and he says, "I should have listened to you. You know, we should have ran, and we should have taken..." She goes, "No." She goes, "Yeah, I said that. I said that to do this." She goes, "We have to put this over on everyone. We have to put this over on everyone." And he's like, "Yes, we have to do the best that we've ever done, because it's the only way we're going to get out of this, get it behind us, and start a life." And the way that everything was manipulated to the end, where Jennifer Lawrence says, "I want a divorce," instead of when Christian Bale said he wanted the divorce, and how they had everything set in time so that when everything came down at the end, and again, Christian Bale's Irving goes to see Polito to tell him, "Look, I got to be straight up with you." And two people say, "Look, I have to be real with you." Amy Adams says it to Bradley Cooper, and she loses the accent. She goes, "I got to be real with you." Christian Bale goes to Polito and says, "I have to be real with you." And that was a very hard scene for me. It was hard because it was emotional. And I was like, oh, my God. And he knew he was going to lose this friendship. And I felt that character of Irving was really hurt, because he was going to lose his best friend. And he even says, "I lost my friend."
And I'm not saying that I didn't feel those parts, because I did. And there were some beautiful, beautiful scenes. There's also some golden moments in this film that I love, just to name one, like when Bradley Cooper is holding her foot, mm-hmm. and she's sitting on the counter and he's just holding her foot.
Yeah.
Wonderful. That's completely off track of what I was saying. I got totally distracted. No, but back to the love story and what they're saying. I already recognized that they both had the potential to really care about someone because they cared about each other.
Mm-hmm.
So when he goes to Polito and is like, I want to be your, like, you were my friend. I want to be honest with you. And she goes to Bradley Cooper and is like, I won't drop this. I kind of already knew they had the potential to have emotions and have relationships and to be real because we'd already seen it. So I wasn't surprised. I wasn't like, oh, to me, that wasn't that big of an arc because they weren't they were selfish people in the beginning, but they still had feelings for each other and let each other in. And I don't know.
No, I mean, but what happens is that together they grow. I mean, they grow, they realize, or Christian or Irving realizes, listen, I can't go on. Like, mm-hmm. she's the one for me. And as far as, you know, and as far as Amy Adams goes, what's great about her and the dialogue, I think, in the movie is that from the get-go, she says, listen, if we're going to do this, I'm going to get very close to this guy, very close to this guy. You have to be all right with it. Because I didn't for one minute ever think, I think she might have been taken a little bit by his wily ways, but I don't think she fell for him at all. She was playing him, and she knew, and she couldn't get too close. And, you know, it's just Christian. She was just so good at it that even Christian Bale was getting killed. Yeah, I mean, that was the
thing. Here's my question, though. Sorry. Go ahead.
You know, early on in the movie, she says, you know, we haven't slept together, and then we kind of come back to that point, and you're like, okay, there's always that wonder, are they going to sleep together now? And they still at no point do it.
No.
And that's why, when she reveals this, I have an accent thing, he just gets so frustrated over that aspect of it, like, why can't I bed you?
Yeah.
For me, Bradley Cooper's character, I think it's interesting because, yes, he has a lot of bad traits, but ultimately he does just want justice. And I think he's a man in a world, he just can't keep up. And the great scene when Christian Bale takes him to the paintings and, you know, like there's a fake painting. And so I think he's just coming to terms with the fact that all of life is unreal or this and that. And he just doesn't know how to comprehend it. It frustrates him.
Well, in interviews, Bradley Cooper describes him as kind of like a 15-year-old kid.
Yeah.
He's just like this child that's kind of trying to go up in the world. But my question is about Sydney's relationship to him, is how he fooled her in the first place and got to her to like drop her card and bring him into the meeting for the loans. Because they talk about, and they make a point to be like, something's in the way, your emotions are in the way, two lunches, you didn't need two lunches, like what's going on with you? And because she's been so drawn in by him, she lets her guard down, which is why she hands him the money. And then it's a little muddled where that gets, I don't know. So she liked him at first, realized she's bad, and then all of those flirtatious feelings actually drop, but she fakes them?
Well, what scene in particular are you talking about that gives him the money?
Remember, that's when she gets caught.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's, he hands her the check. Yes. Or he hands the check.
And
she accepts the check.
And the reason that she does that is because she's been so taken in by him in her interviews with him.
Right, she trusts him.
Yes.
But yet, at the same time, too, you know, note that Bradley Cooper is still trying to play one on her. It was a very interesting mm-hmm. thing that he said to her, he goes, you know, he's using you. He goes, why didn't he take the check? He knew. He knew something was wrong. He let you take the check. He let you take the fall. My thing is, if you notice the cons before, he was accepting checks. He was, like, literally grabbing onto checks left and right.
He realized.
He just felt he didn't have the time to go, don't, like, what's going on here?
No, I think he did. He noticed something was off, and she didn't know something was off because she was taken in by him.
But before he could do anything, because you see that he clearly can see something's off,
mm-hmm.
and he stands up. She's standing a little bit ahead of him, and she just goes ahead and grabs the check.
Uh-huh.
And she takes the check because I agree with you that she was taken and she believed him. So everybody was trying to con everybody. And she took the check, and then she ended up in the slammer. I mean, he kept her there for 3 days. I mean, he was still playing her. And as far as his, I like you stuff.
What do you think her emotional attachment tracked throughout this film is? At first, she's in love with Christian Bale. She's in love with Christian Bale. She has a little flirtatious encounter with this guy. So she drops her guard, ends up in jail.
Right.
And then...
And then I believe that then the con is on. Mm-hmm. I believe that.
And where does she stand emotionally? Because she's kind of been messed up and.
Well, he played with her. I think emotionally, to be honest, the way I took it, and I could be completely off. Mm-hmm. The way I took it is.
She this always guy, loves Christian Bale.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. She loves him. Mm-hmm. Like to a point where it's unequivocal. Mm-hmm. But she knows that he's married. She's got to get rid of that. But again, this cop guy mm-hmm. is a guy that scammed her.
Yeah.
And she wants, again, the way I viewed it, she'll do anything to try to get back. She does not look. She knows this guy's a dunce.
Okay. So and it was just the only emotional connection and she ever had to him was before she found out she was accused of cop when it was just a flirtation.
He was a means thing. Of. That she could use him, and she even said, I'm gonna make him so fall in love, and we're gonna keep him because in case we need him for another play.
No,
and Christian Bale's like, we won't need another play. She goes, we're gonna need another play. And I think in the back of her mind, you know, she had to, I think that there was something that there was an attractiveness to, you know, I think that was there. I just think that character in the back of her mind said, look, I can't let this, I'm not going to let him get in. I got to do whatever I can. I'll pretend. I mean, the scene in the bathroom, to me, said it all. I mean, that was a primal scream.
Oh, you liked the primal scream?
Yeah. I mean, to me, that because that was the first time that she said, we're not going to fuck now. Mm-hmm. We're going to do it when this is we're going to do it when this is all done and blah blah blah, and that's keeping him at bay. And but he's just like, I mean, they're in a bathroom stall and he has a dress up and like
and everyone's screaming, what are you doing?
That scene was great. She goes, this is fucking weird. She goes, I fucking really have to go to the bathroom. Like all the people are, would you hurry up and get out already? The scene was great. And at the same time, when she finally gets him out, she's like, I just think it's just a release of, oh my God, what am I doing? Okay. What am I getting myself? Like, holy cow.
Because I completely agree with you that I thought she liked Christian Bale the whole time. Like, I always felt that she loved him all the way through. So to me, I was always just like, I was a little bit confused with her initial flirtation with Bradley Cooper's character before she got caught. That why she was flirting with him when they had such a wonderful, epic love, I didn't know if it was like him just overreacting or if she really did have this flirtatious attraction to him. And that confused me just a little bit because I was like, if she can go back to him and love Christian Bale so thoroughly and they're supposed to be the one true match, like why did she need to flirt with this?
Yeah.
Guy, he's not all that great.
And remember, too, to me, what's great about David O. Russell's script is that they both sort of come to this conclusion together. They sort of come to this, like, yeah, which is what I really love. And they know that they, together, that they are great. That they do actually, they have the same,
and,
you know,
and I taste I in love music their relationship. And, yeah. I love their relationship. Music, great.
Yeah.
Just their chemistry, their little, like, story. Yeah. I really did love.
What are your thoughts? We haven't really given you much time. Sorry.
No worries. You know, to me, in terms of how it opened up, I love the way that it opened up with, I mean, it was, for what it was a bit lengthy in terms of him setting up his hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a good way to basically visually say everything about this guy is fake.
What I really want, can I interrupt you again? Well, you know what I really wanted to happen? The whole time, I really wanted them to hide a wire in his toupee. I wanted to happen so bad. Because they made
why?
Because they made such a big deal about this, like his comb over and like little thing in there. And they're like, where are we going to hide this wire? And they end up hiding it in her purse. But I wanted it to be in his hair so bad. I was like, please.
That's funny.
Please put it in his hair. Because it would just be great. But they didn't. But, and I was let down.
You know, and I also thought the storytelling technique was interesting, where they start there. You know, we start timeline wise kind of in the middle of things.
Sure.
Then go back and continue from there. I thought that was interesting. What I liked about it is immediately after, you know, in that scene of like, don't touch his hair. It takes him a long time. You know, and I loved knowing kind of, again, looking back on it, knowing the timeline and the order of events in their worlds, I like that because she's still sticking up for him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it shows that she really does understand
him. Yeah, and what did you think about that scene, actually? Because that's a really, it's an interesting, because to me, that scene, that's where I was sold. Christian Bale, he spent all his time, and as Christian Bale has said, he goes, this guy's supposed to be a great con man. He ain't conning anybody with that hair. Like, that just ain't happening. Mm-hmm. And that whole scene, because he just lets it all out. You see the gut, you see the cowlick, you see the hair, he's putting on the glue. It's a process. And when, so he comes out, and automatically he's like, yeah, you've been with my girl. So that's what this is about. And he's like, don't touch me. He goes, you know, and she's, yeah, he doesn't like to be touched. He goes, doesn't like to be, you mean, if I wanted to humiliate you, I would do this. And when he did that, I was like, even I was like, huh. It's like, yeah. It was, he looked ludicrous, but Christian Bale's slope, like his thing, like I thought he was going to explode. He just stood there and I was like, oh my head. And it was, for me, that was sucked in right there. And to your point, I think you're right. Amy Adams is like, especially she was pissed off at Bradley
scene,
Cooper.
Yeah. Great scene.
Yeah.
Visually, dialogue, everything, great. But gives away the whole movie. You can dissect the whole movie out of the scene. You know what's going to happen. You know that she still loves him. You know that she's going to be on his side. You know that Bradley Cooper is the one who goes over the top and that he's the one who can contain himself and it's going to plan all the way through.
But here's the thing. It's a, obviously,
like, I
it's,
just knew where everything was going to end up.
But it's a choice because at that point it's dramatic irony. You know, why do you like watching movies a second time? Sometimes they're better than the first is because, you know, it's just the journey of getting there.
And to me, it was. I mean, again, I can't say that I knew where this movie was going. I actually thought, like, you know, watching the movie the first time, I actually said, Jesus. I go, this thing, like, this con is going to, I go, if it were almost a conventional thing, that con would have gone bad. And then it would be, how do we get out of this mess?
Yeah.
But how things worked out, you're like, I didn't see that end coming. I didn't see the con coming. And then how Bradley Cooper got his comeuppance, I didn't see coming. But it was awesome the way that it did. And yeah, for me, like that end, like the ending was, for me, it was great. And to David O. Russell's point, that's how he, when you think about his movies, and you, let's, Silver Linings, great ending,
movie.
Right?
Great
but it
movie.
Didn't have a very satisfying ending. I mean, because wasn't there at least one time where you thought maybe they weren't going to get together throughout? Like maybe he was going to take that route and be the sad love story instead of the happy love story, but it was the happy love story. They ended up together. Same thing with The Fighter. With Amy Adams, like, you don't exactly know. Maybe now if David O. Russell makes another movie, maybe I'll go into it with, the rose covered. Maybe he'll try to do something different. But, you know, The Fighter again, when, you know, with Mark Wahlberg reuniting with his family and the relationship he has with Amy Adams, you know, it just really works. And again, you have two, in The Fighter, you had two redemptions. You had Christian Bale's, the drug addict brother. You had Mark Wahlberg coming into the ring and you know, doing what he had to do.
And I would even say Amy Adams, because
Amy Adams,
what I loved about that movie, you know, he says to her, like, what have I fought Sugar Ray? What have you ever done besides bartended?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know what I mean? But that's a whole different movie.
You're right. Yeah. Maybe we should do the trilogy. I mean, those are two great movies worthy of talking about.
The Coronado trilogy.
Yeah. Well, you know, but that's what I was thinking of. It was, in a sense, I thought the same thing when I was doing my notes. So this is like a different Coronado trilogy. I mean, there are common themes, and David O. Russell says, yeah, that they can be considered a trilogy only because of their themes. And
yeah,
when I watch it, yeah, absolutely.
What I think, you know, going back to the beginning, what I loved about it is that, you know, it set it up, and again, knowing what we know now, just Bradley, he is like a 15-year-old kid because he, you know, he moves the suitcase and it's like, dude. And part of the whole thing is, you know, had you just let Christian Bale's character take control, not messed him up, because that obviously threw him off his element. He was now angry at you and he wasn't as willing to fix things. Things might have gone better right off the start.
Right.
But you moved the suitcase.
Yeah.
And it just, it all went
south.
Yeah.
To an extent.
It went south before that.
So, and it's just because I think in that moment that sealed Bradley Cooper's fate.
Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing is you got to know that character because that took place at the beginning of the movie. And then when you, again, starting from the midway point, so to speak, but as you got to see Bradley Cooper's character, well, of course he was going to push the case. Like, yeah. You understand why more. Mm-hmm. But again, even the way, aside from the fact that he beat the shit out of his boss, okay, I mean, he never let his boss finish the ice fishing story. And it was funny to me because I don't know why, but I sort of kind of cared. First off, Louis C.K. has been in two movies this year, Blue Jasmine, and in this movie, and both times I was like, is this Louis C.K.? I mean, I thought he did really good in this movie. Really good. And when he started telling the ice fishing story, I remember because the first time he said it, he says it was like mid-October, the ice was thin and blah, blah, blah. He goes, oh, so you're trying to save me? You know, you don't want me to fall through thin ice? He goes, no, that's not it. All right. And he just leaves. When he picks up the ice story fishing again, he goes, oh, you got to finish that story. And Louis C.K.'s like, where did I leave off? I said, mid-October, thin ice. He goes, oh, it was a blizzard. And I was like, what? And then you just got that Bradley Cooper was not paying attention whatsoever. And, you know, that, I mean, he was just such a douche, like, throughout the movie. And he's like, oh, so you want to do it? He goes, no, that's not the point. Goes, all right, whatever. And he kept on walking. Him.
You know? You're right. You're correct in the sense that it is very ironic because later, as they're being after he beats him up and they're being reprimanded together, he goes, "You were a great mentor to me." Still want to know, and I believe he says, "I still want to know the ending to the ice fishing story."
Ice fishing story. Yeah, it's
like, in order to have a mentor, you have to accept their mentorship,
right?
So I don't. Yes, you're correct in that irony.
It's just it was just
your
great.
Mentor also needs to not hate you
or beat you
think,
up.
Here's the thing, I don't think
beat you up with the phone or pull a gun out on you.
Well, that was the mentoree.
Yeah,
but I think Louis C.K.'s character didn't hate him. He was frustrated with him and thought he was going about it the wrong way. But until he got beat up, I don't think he was. You know,
so much more enamored. Yeah, I agree. I think he sort of kind of could see potential. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mean, he was just going off the page. He was doing whatever he felt that he needed to get done. And he wanted to be, because there was even a part where he's talking to him. And he goes, I'm in charge of this operation. He said, yeah, I need this for this operation. And it's my, you know, I need this for my operation. He's like, this isn't your operation. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a
part. But he became, Bradley Cooper's, what I liked about that is that he became kind of everyone's, you know, pet and it, way to get stuff. It was like, okay, well, we need $10 million. And so at that point, no matter what, it was never his operation, because they were like, dude, we need the suite and we need $10 million. Dude, I need $10 million. Like, yeah. No, you're not calling any shots.
Yeah.
I liked about the ice fishing aspect was that every time he guessed the ending, it was kind of where you expected it to go. And
right.
It was very, like, accurate. And there was the frustration, like, well, no, that's not my story. I'm going to change it in my head because I want you to be wrong.
No, I actually think that to Louis C.K.'s character, I think he was like, no, that's not what I was going to say. I was going to bring this up. And, you know, and there even comes a point where he goes, my brother died, okay? And you're like, Bradley Cooper doesn't care.
He's you know? Like, years after, but
and when you look at the relationship too, it's funny because you look at that relationship and then you look at the relationship between Irving and Polito. And that relationship was like a solid, like, relationship. I mean, one of the best scenes, it was that night that they went out.
The
Delilah. See, oh, I mean, Delilah, you know, and like actually seeing, Christian Bale do the, you know, he did the gopher dance, sort of, kind of, from Caddyshack. He's, like, doing this. I mean, that was great. But then when they end up in the diner the next morning, and he goes, hey, I got a gift for you. And he opens up the trunk of his car and goes, here, it's science. It's a microwave because it heats up food. It can heat up lasagna, pasta. He's like, you bought this for me? And I'm thinking, bought it? It seems like it probably fell off the back of a truck. But he's like, yeah, yeah. And, I mean, it just, that sealed the, and to Christian Bale, he's like, wow, it's almost like I have a friend. And it's like, you could tell he's never had any true friends because of the life that he chose to be. He never had true friends. And I think he really enjoyed spending his time with, you know, with that character, with Polito.
But again, it just, it was a nice point where he had to get his life in order. You know, again, he was never really true. He wasn't true with him. And so while this friendship was a good friendship, just, you know, in terms of the microwave, what's funny is that, okay, the microwave is fake because it's, you know, now it's, you know, what, you want to poison us? You want to poison us? You bring poison into here and then it starts fires. Look what he did to the... And then he wants her at the dinner. He's like, you gotta come. Of course. Why wouldn't she come? She's gotta come.
He's like, what, do you got a girlfriend on the side? I understand these things. But, you know, but it going, that to me is like the Jennifer Lawrence conundrum that I had. She's either, again, I said, she's either really stupid or she's very smart. And by stupid, it's like, oh, mommy started a fire. How did that happen? Well, did you know that there's sun and lamps? And she left this. And I was like, I was trying to put that together. I completely forgot, but it was a freaking tanning lamp that caused the fire. And it's like, what idiot? You just go idiot. And then when he says, don't put metal in the microwave. She puts the biggest slab of, huh? She puts,
and
like,
she's saying it out loud. Out loud. Don't put metal in the microwave. Don't put metal in the microwave.
You know, and then, but she turns the argument around to her when she says, these things sap out all the nutrients. You know, and, but at the same time, when she talks to her mob boyfriend and she says, well, he's on the phone with somebody from the IRS, was that stupidity? Or was that just plain old flat out manipulation that she knew that Irving was gonna?
I think she was smarter than she appeared to be.
I think so. I think so. What do you think? Or do you think she was just so stupid she didn't think?
Like, I don't think she was so stupid. I think that. This sounds horrible. I think that you can kind of be both.
Mm-hmm.
There are these people I met who literally, like, really smart, and, like, while they're telling you about, like, neuroscience and all these crazy things, they're, like, simultaneously with the other hand, like, about to stick their fingers in a socket. And you're like, right. This doesn't work, but somehow you're the same person.
Yeah.
So I think she was definitely both.
But at the same time, her confrontation with Amy Adams' character, like, was anything but stupid. Like, it was a calculated, her actions are very calculated. And even Amy Adams, like, they talk about, the kiss in the bathroom. And that apparently was, although I can't quite figure out.
Amy Adams' idea. It was either Amy Adams' idea. She praises Jennifer for how she executed it.
Yeah, and David O. Russell's like, well, yeah, Jennifer Lawrence, you know. But that scene, like, Amy Adams is like, that laugh afterwards as she walks away is just so maniacal. It devastated me. And, you know, in that way, she gets the upper hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene was so, it was above catty. It was, like, vicious. And it was such a great scene together.
And I mean, you know, and ironically, she's not, right? She wanted to be there. Early on in the movie, she said, you know, it's to gain whatever she needs. So, you know, I don't like to go out.
Yeah.
You love to go out.
You love to
go. It just doesn't benefit you.
Right.
Let's talk about the different characters. I definitely want to talk about Robert De Niro. Let's talk about the Sheik, though. I want to talk about the Sheik. What did you guys think of him just as a plot device and then as an actor?
Michael Peña?
Yeah.
Well, as the Sheik, not the first guy who's from Brooklyn I sell siding. That guy with Michael Peña's character. Yeah.
What happened to my guy?
What happened to my guy? Yeah.
So this is, like, based off a true story somewhat. You can say you're lying, you know, somebody's blah, 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 blah. And they did use a Sheik, and they did use multiple people in the FBI to play him. So I thought that, for me, it worked because it did pull from real life, and, like, I liked the Sheik as a device. But part of me was convinced because it was part of the true story.
What I liked about it was the A, just it lended itself to so much comedy. It's like, A, this isn't my guy. B, this is how shitty your guy is.
Right.
Like, he does not... First off, he's Mexican.
He's
Mexican. B, does he know how to speak it? No, he doesn't. Oh, my God.
He know I know Salam Aleikum and a couple of other phrases. He's like, what are you...
But it's true to Christian Bale's real frustration. If we're gonna do, you have to be more convincing than what is real.
You have to do it from the feet up.
Yeah.
And if the dude can't even speak,
right,
we got a problem.
But you know, it led to a great scene.
Oh,
and you
did.
Were gonna talk about De Niro.
Yes.
And it led to an amazingly tense scene
because. You know, from my perspective, we'll speak to Robert, but what I loved about it is that's when the first moment of, like, because all this time, Christian Bale's character is telling you, again, you have to be more real than real. And, dude, because you didn't listen to me, it could all fall apart, and it's not on me, it's on you.
Right. Yeah. And as things play out, like, even in the overvoice, like, who would have known we were dealing with a mobster that spoke Arabic? Like, yeah. Who would have ever known that? Obviously, throughout his time of being a con man, the whole Sheik deal was definitely an Irving device. I mean, he was using a Sheik to get his deals done, whether it be an art scam or whatever. So he knew how to do this, he and Amy Adams. And they were like, well, I just need to use an FBI guy. Yeah, he's Mexican, he'll pass. And he's like, no. He goes, give me the knife. That scene with the knife and explaining to him, like... This knife is like your light. Like, you are handing this over. And I just love the way that it's shot.
It right. When he actually hands over the knife. It's still like, and I was like.
Yeah, you're like, oh, this is not going to end well. But when they get, so many things could have gone drastically wrong when they went to that casino place between Jennifer Lawrence's character approaching the mob people and Amy Adams' glance was just like. You're going to get us killed. And then going into the private room.
And on top of that, you're a horrible wife.
Right. And on top of it all.
I know why he should leave you.
Yeah. Rosalind. But yeah, that scene is that you're right. That scene really is telling as to how much Bradley Cooper doesn't know.
And he's just trying to force it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to do, you have to be real slick.
Yeah.
What did you like about the scene, Sarah?
About the Robert De Niro scene in the back room where they have the thought. Is that when the flashback happens of him shooting someone in the street?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I was waiting for someone to get killed this whole movie, so I was glad that was in there.
Oh. And isn't that nice?
Glad that scene paid off.
Well, you know, they showed that scene in the trailer. And not to interrupt, but in the trailer, I never had a hint that Robert De Niro was in this movie. And that scene is quickly in the trailer, and I would never have said that's Robert De Niro. So, yeah, go ahead. So somebody died and got killed.
I like that they brought him in. I like that they brought someone who kind of raised the stakes even more, that this wasn't just money and politics, but they put their lives in danger. And it really, that whole blame, again, was falling on Bradley Cooper's shoulders. And they were constantly... making him more and more the bad guy.
Yeah.
That I really enjoyed.
And it was...
And I like when you up the stakes and you put it... Make it more absolutely. Dramatic.
It was the first time anybody was in a true Jeopardy moment. Like, to your point of upping the stakes. This was the time... That scene introduced true life danger. Like, life-threatening kind of danger that could have permeated through...
But what worked was at that point, you know, their friendship or the con, whatever you want to call it, Christian Bale and Jeremy Renner, you know, Jeremy, he kind of stands up and says, well, everything's good, you know, however he says it, everything's good. Like, no, he's, you know, because of knowing what he did, you know, as falsely as the knife was handed to him, it's such a big, like, this is, remember their confrontation? Right. This is fake? This means nothing?
Yeah.
You know, so very there was sad. Such an emphasis put on that stuff. And so at that point, you know, that's what kind of did save him was Jeremy Renner, obviously the direct thing, but Christian Bale's manipulation of everything.
Yeah, and Christian Bale, too. It was gutsy what he did in that one scene. Because Christian Bale's like, as soon as they mention, as soon as the De Niro character mentioned, well, and he gave all the right reasons. He's like, look, we can't do this. We got the Olympics. You know, we got we can't have an Arab. It's very, you know, nobody's going to want to touch this. We got to make him, we have to make him an American citizen. And then he goes, well, that's going to need politicians. And Christian Bale's like, you know what? I don't like more like to Christian Bale, this thing is starting to spiral out of so much control that in his head, he's like, what have I gotten myself into with this Bobo? Like now we got to bribe politicians. He goes, and right there was that light came on. The stakes were raised. Yeah. And then De Niro's like, who is this guy? You know, but Polito stands up for him in that scene. But, I mean, the scene just plays out on so many levels because you had the women outside. Oh, and did you also notice, too, that when Jennifer Lawrence approaches the mob guys, did you notice that Polito's wife, who they were really friendly, she sort of, like, backs away from her? She's sort of, like, hands off, like, well, that girl's crazy.
She kind of switches sides.
Yeah.
She ends up kind being on Amy Adams' side.
Yeah.
And they're sitting at the table together in the end because... Right. She represents a good wife. Right. She has a good husband who has somehow put himself in a kind of a sticky situation, too. But they are a good, solid family. They make a point of that, of always kind of keeping their households, why she wants them around. She thinks she's found another good wife.
Right.
And when she goes over the bar, she realizes it's a window in for her to realize she's not really in the best situation either. Right. And that's why she switches
sides. Yeah. It was interesting. It was an interesting thing. I was like, ooh, she's staying away from Jennifer Lawrence now.
Well, Jennifer Lawrence threw up some red flags.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So.
And the last kind of character that I thought was major that I want to talk about is, I can't remember his name, but, you know, the guy who's mediating Louis C.K. and Bradley Cooper.
Oh, yeah.
The other official who's kind of trying to make a name for himself.
Yeah, which, by the way, you know, you spoke about how Bradley Cooper's trying to make a name for himself. I thought it was interesting because in the narration, that's who Christian Bale said is trying to... So I thought my mind went to that, and that's why initially I didn't think Bradley Cooper was trying to make a name for himself. He was just trying to do the right thing.
Right, now, that gentleman
everyone's
is...
Corrupt.
Is Alessandro Nivola is the actor's name, and he...
He played Anthony Amato.
Anthony Amato, who in the story was, in a sense, he was a successful Bradley Cooper. Because it said that he wanted the limelight, and that's why he originally, hey, I want to go with this guy. This guy can get these things done, and he can make this big. And like, and they even said that he was a politician, or he was a high-point politician, but he liked the limelight and he wanted to put things down.
Oh, I thought
down.
He was Louis C.K.'s boss.
It wasn't, no, he
I'm so confused.
He was in charge of...
I forget what his title
I always thought he was kind of like the intersection between like politics and the FBI.
Something like that, in the sense that you have to report to him, you know, how the FBI and things like that, they have to report to an outside facility. I don't know how to word it.
Yeah.
But he wasn't their boss. He wasn't affiliated with the FBI. I just think, you know, you eventually have to go to, it's like you have to go, if a cop has to get a warrant, you go to a judge.
Right.
That type of, you know, it's on that level.
And something interesting about him, he was born in Boston, Massachusetts. Yay.
Great con artist come from Boston.
Yeah, that's right. So. So what about that character? Were you...
I just liked, you know, I thought, you know, him wanting to make a name for himself and things like that. It was interesting the part that he did play by the end. You know, initially there wasn't much given to him. And then by the end, he was a very pinnacle person because, you know, as soon as... I mean, for all intents and purposes, Louis C.K. and Bradley Cooper got suspended. And it's like, okay, all decisions go through me. We're doing this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they did it.
I think we should talk about the style of this film.
Wait, but did we want to talk about De Niro at all? Because I knew you wanted to.
Well, I think we did in that sense. I mean, obviously, this was no Silver Linings Playbook for him. But it was nice to see him... based on, you know, and I thought, again, not a great role, but finally, you know, we're still seeing great acting from him.
Intimidating as hell.
Yeah.
Still. Like, yeah. He could stare you down, and you knew, like, when he said, you know, our organization knows how to run things, and, you know, you... When he said our organization, I mean, it was just, yeah, you could tell. And when he's looking, when he speaks Arabic to the Sheik, you're like, oh, my head, what is going to happen? And then it was a great save by Michael Pena, you know, but that scene was going on. And as you're reading the subtitles, it's like, well, do you understand what I'm saying? And if it wasn't for that drunk guy who crashed into the table... Like, and again, you're just like, whoa, you know, but that gave Michael Pena's character as the Sheik to get up and throw whatever else Arabic he knew and said, yeah, the deal's good and whatever. And then De Niro's character's like, okay, never to be seen from again.
Yeah.
But again, he just set the peril for the rest of the movie. The peril was there.
Yes. So let's switch gears. We've been talking, obviously, about writing, acting, story, and all that fun stuff. Let's switch gears into more of the technical.
Is there much more style?
Well, it's style and technique. So let's talk about costuming.
Do you want me to bring up that there was a bunch of cleavage?
Sure. You just did. So talk about that.
There was a lot of cleavage.
As a female, do you notice this a lot?
I mean, I think I was forced to notice it in this movie. It was pretty in your face. Didn't bother me. But I was like, there's a lot of cleavage.
I don't think the guys are unhappy about
that. There were some great
that.
Dresses. Some great clothes. But instead of one statement piece in the movie, there was like 50 statement pieces.
And what's wrong with that?
I didn't say there was anything wrong with
that. It made the movie big.
Yeah.
There was a lot of style to it. I liked the music. I liked... I liked the sequence. There you go.
You know what? I thought from a costuming perspective, which worked into the story, is that Amy Adams' character dresses Christian Bale's character.
Yeah.
And then eventually Bradley. I thought that was interesting. Let's go into it. Let's talk about, you know, so let's start with the dresses then. 50 exactly dresses?
And just there was 50. A lot of outfits in this movie. Got three actresses, all of cleavage. But I thought it added some pizzazz. I thought that the style worked specifically because he did own also the dry cleaners and
sure.
How they pulled that in and pulled her wardrobe in. And the fact
great
that
scene,
she
by
does
the ways.
Her whole life, yes, and her whole life is being a character. So the fact that she does like embrace that and just go through these routines and it fit for specifically Amy Adams' wardrobe, I thought it was great that it was so over the top. She came from being a stripper to being Lady Edith and having all these free clothes. To me, it worked.
Yeah.
To me, that's how she should be dressing, was that.
I mean, a lot of the dress, yeah, right? They were sparkling things. You know, everything, I thought the key imagery was all about sparkles and mirrors, right? So when you have the, you know, as your outfit does, you know, you can kind of see reflections and things like that. And remember, they had that one great shot of them dancing and you pan up and then it's the gold and then you see them dancing from the mirror. Mm-hmm. So it all correlated together in terms of visuals.
Mm-hmm. What I really liked about the costuming is it could have gone to parody. Like, outside of Christian Bale's hair, the whatever clothing the characters were wearing seemed to be this is going to sound weird because the movie took place in the 70s, but it seemed very appropriate for the time, and it didn't overdo it. It didn't overstate it. You know, it didn't look Austin Powers-ish. You know, it totally fit whatever time we were watching this movie in, and I appreciated that it didn't look like parody or, you know, and I think it could have been a fine line. They could have made the decision to make them look, you know, sort of buffoonish in the 70s clothing, because some 70s clothing was completely off the charts. Mm-hmm. But I think for these characters, it made them not only look the part, but it made them more real, because it was...
And I think, you know, to that point, real fast, any buffoonishness that came from the characters was on their own behalf, right? So Bradley Cooper with the and Jennifer Lawrence with the half-burnt face from the...
And her hair.
Yeah, you did it to themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, it's... again, when you're doing a movie about the 70s, I was never huge on 70s fashion, but, I do think that you can... It could be a fine line to walk when it comes to costuming. It all depends on what kind of a movie that you want to make. I think the costuming in this particular movie, it worked. I thought the design was fine.
I agree. I think that it was also in kind of the color scheme of how the movie looked that it didn't seem too
true.
Over the top.
Yeah.
It was because of how they shot it. Nothing was like, although they were statement pieces, mm-hmm. they weren't too bright.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah. There was a tone to them that they all kind of blended.
Yeah. And even like Polito's,
his hair was amazing.
Hair. Yeah.
I want that hair.
It was great. But his, a politician from New Jersey, I never doubted the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
On their over-the-top work.
Exactly. And I actually really enjoy your point. I think you're right. Everything that looked buffoonish was what they did to themselves. Like when Bradley Cooper is having that, again, it's great. He goes, I'm doing it on my own terms. And he's got the curlers in his hair. Like, how can you take that seriously?
Side note. I should have pulled in the scene. Is this the scene where his fiance's in the room?
Yeah.
That was a little crazy to me.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just because I thought she was lying about the fiance for a second, because I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Where's this fiance coming from? And this is the most awkward way to deal with a fiance I've ever seen.
I know.
Yeah, I thought it would have just been his sister. That would have been, you know what I mean? But I think you didn't really need her. I mean, obviously, they referenced her like, hey, you're here with me and you have a fiance back home. Like, it was referenced and it was used, but... You didn't need it. You had the perfect love triangle regardless.
I think that it further proves that everybody was trying to con everybody. Like, to me, when you find out that he has a fiance, even Amy Adams is like, wait, what? Is that a fiance? And he's like, yeah, don't worry about it. And she's in the room.
Yeah, like, she's like, what?
She goes, I am your fiance. What do you mean?
Yeah, see, that was just confusing to me, especially because... I think with it, we developed to think that Bradley Cooper was enough of a douchebag, or at least a kid who got carried away and had these shots of glory. But then you also had him with his fiance that he was just outright denying-ish. And I was confused, like,
character-wise. Yeah, I'm sort of engaged, yeah.
I'm like, you're a cop. If you're a cop who gets, like, carried away down the wrong path and gets a little too greedy, it's one thing. But if at the exact same time, while you're, like, escalating... You're already kind of at that level with your fiance status. I'm confused.
Yeah, I just think he just wanted it all. He felt with the power, he felt that by taking the lead, he goes, look at what I'm going to get from this. I'm going to get the media. This is going to make my career. I'm going to answer to no one. He goes, I have people working for me, Ma. And he had nobody working for him.
Yeah.
It's a testament to the acting.
He is wonderful at playing the frazzled asshole.
Isn't he?
He's really good.
He really is.
He really embraced that one.
But I think, it's funny. Again, we opened up, who do you root for in this movie? And if you look at Bradley Cooper's character in Silver Linings Playbook, mm-hmm. at the beginning of the movie, he was that character. I hate. He was annoying. I hated him.
He was a frazzled asshole.
Totally.
Yeah.
But in Silver Linings, though, again, he has his redemption. He changes, and you end up liking him a lot. And it's part of that relationship. But when you look at American Hustle, when you're looking at Christian Bale, and they're con people. They're conning people. It's not a great. It's not a straight up good job to have. They recognize that, and by the end, it's behind them. And I actually love the scene with Amy Adams and his son at the end when they were at the school. And I think that to me, David O. Russell's vision for that, I love that. And even Jennifer Lawrence gets who she wants.
Yeah. So in terms of let's talk about the cinematography, because I think it ties so well. What I love seeing, there's a lot of great behind the scenes for many movies, where you have the cinematographers work with the costumers, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to just pick out costumes that look well, but then in working with the lighting team of, okay, how is it going to shine? You know, it may look like this in this light, but how is it going to look under the light of this in conjunction with what we're trying to do on camera and things like that? And again, to that point, I think they nailed it.
Yeah. The cinematography of this movie, number one, did you realize that it was primarily shot in Boston?
I did.
That they and they only shot like two scenes in New York
because they didn't need to. You know what I mean?
No, but I thought that was they didn't. I found out about Boston like later because they did a great job of hiding anything that might have been iconic to Boston.
Like, I mean, they hid everything that could have been iconic to most places. Right.
But when they were in New York City, like there was that scene with Christian Bale and Amy Adams as they're crossing the street, and it looked like it could have been, I don't know, like. On Broadway or Times Square or something. But no, I thought the cinematography matched like perfectly. It got the look down. Just great. And it didn't overdo it. It didn't overstate, much like the costuming. It played it so away that you
fantastic.
Felt it looked fantastic.
It looked fantastic.
Much like Argo, I'll say. Going back to our Argo comparison, because Argo captured the 70s really well too. And it didn't overstate it, and I felt that the same here. It just the guy's name was Linus Sandgren, and I hadn't heard about this guy before. He's from Sweden. This is basically what I got up, and he worked on Promised Land.
Unlike Argo, though, Argo was a lot of kind of more close-ups and things like that. This, again, even though we didn't see iconic things from New York and New Jersey and things like that, we stayed primarily in wide shot. You know, we got to, because again, David O. Russell's things are very ensemble like.
Yeah.
And so you want to kind of see, you know, everyone's so brilliant in it. Why wouldn't you show them both in the frame?
Right.
So I felt that they played to that well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was really complemented very well by the editing, yeah. I thought. Jay Cassidy, I thought he worked with Alec Baumgarten and Crispin Struthers. But I thought that Jay Cassidy and team did a great job. Interesting story about the Live and Let Die.
Oh, scene. I might know this story, so you go.
It was basically shot in one take, but they had to have a backup because they didn't know if they can get the licensing to the song. And they figured it would cost $1 bazillion. So they shot the scene, and they also shot a backup scene. And by stroke of luck, Colleen Camp, who played Brenda the Wire Girl, she was good friends with Barbara Broccoli, who's part of the Broccoli family that owns James Bond. They reached out. She said, oh, okay, well, you know, we'll have to go to Sir Paul McCartney. And Sir Paul McCartney's like, nobody's ever asked to license this song before. Live and Let Die has only been licensed to one movie, and that's the title, Live and Let Die. Never before had we seen that, which I didn't know, and fascinating. And Sir Paul McCartney was gracious, so he said, sure, by all means. So, but they had their backup, which was Evil Ways. So they filmed the scene twice in case they couldn't get the song they wanted. But I thought it was great that they did that all in one take.
Yeah.
And he goes, you've never seen Live and Let Die by somebody cleaning with gloves.
And I will actually have a different story on this scene to you. That this came to him in a vision about her character before they even really started writing the script. And she got so into it that she threw out her neck while filming this. Wow. So she actually full-on threw out her neck. I thought it was fun. I love the scene. I don't want them to take it out. But part of me was like, it almost seemed like one of those moments that you put in the middle of the credits. Like, you know, when you're just like, oh, I'm so glad that they added this because I wanted to see it. But almost like that's where it's that type of scene. Does that make sense?
It's a credit scene.
A credit scene?
Kind of.
For what reason?
I don't know. I just feel that way.
You have to back up your opinion, Sarah. No? Okay.
Okay, fair enough. What did you think of that scene?
It's so fun. So fun.
What did I think of it? I don't have... I liked it. I mean, is it a credit scene or not? No, it's not a credit scene.
I thought it worked in the movie, and especially to Live and Let Die.
Yeah.
Like, she was ready. That's it.
Yeah.
You know. I thought the music. I don't know if this is where we're going to go.
We can talk about the music.
Did you have anything else about the editing, or did you like the editing?
I thought all these, right. So we went from costuming to cinematography, now to editing, now to music. Again, all these things work in tandem with each other, supporting what's there. Mm-hmm. You know, none of it takes away or not that it doesn't elevate. It's just the perfect marriage of everything.
Right.
And in terms of the music, what's nice is, you know, it fits with the style of the movie, but then at times it's, it's part of the scenes.
Right.
And, you know, it means something. Like, hey, this, you know, for all intents and purposes, this is our song.
Right.
And I love that aspect of it, bringing that in early. with the records.
Yeah, well, you know, that was a... Again, one of the reasons I love that whole introduction, you know, hey, is that a Duke Ellington bracelet? She goes, yeah. He goes, oh, I love Duke Ellington. She's like, yeah, saved my life, you know, hundreds of times. He goes, really, which song? She's like, Jeep Blues, I think is the name of the song.
And that could have been a con too. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? How many, cause it could have been like a typical guy, like just noticing something like, oh, whatever, you like Jay-Z? I love Jay-Z.
It could have been like a Stifler move. Yeah. I love Twilight.
You know? But the fact that, you know, it, their relationship is based on real.
Right.
So it was nice to see that early on versus...
And it also gives credence to... I mean, Amy Adams, very attractive woman. And, you know, when he takes her, he goes, do you want to hear it? She's like, now? He's like, yeah, come on. And... You know, you see, puts the record on, puts the needle down. They're playing Jeep Blues. It's Duke Ellington at Newport, and then her oval voice kicks in and says, "You know, he's not a guy I should be falling in love." She goes, "You know, right?
Just the fat belly. Yep.
It is the fat belly. You know,
fingers up, a
comb over that was." Inspired? Is that the quote?
I forget the quote.
And he's just like sitting there like this. It's a great, and that is hence they have that, which I don't think that Christian Bale's character, Jennifer Lawrence's character, I don't think she would know who Duke Ellington is.
No, absolutely not.
Right? And
what I like, you know, obviously it's a party, but I just love the amount of trash behind him versus her.
Right.
You know, it's because he comes from, you know, he's a, as great as he is, he's a trashy character.
Yeah. I mean, they're having a pool party in the middle of winter with all these people, you know, the women in the bikinis outside knocking on the door to come on in. Yeah. I mean, it was just another one of those magical scenes. So much, in fact, that I went home and I bought Duke Ellington at Newport. $4.99 on iTunes.
I would buy the soundtrack to this movie in a heartbeat.
I was this close. And Todd Rundgren's song wasn't in the soundtrack. Like half of the song's in there. It's like, I think if you go into iTunes, I think it's only like 11 or 12 songs. And I'm like, I want the double gated album to this. Like I want the deluxe. I want every song on there because I felt that the music to this was a tapestry as well.
Mm-hmm.
It told the story. It told, and it was, and they played everything, even like the disco songs didn't annoy. I mean, it was a lot of fun. Did you get the sense too amongst the actors that like their chemistry really worked, but I got the sense that they were having a good time working off of one another. I felt like, especially when Amy Adams and Bradley Cooper were dancing, and even with Christian Bale and Amy Adams, like I felt that they were all, they were there. They knew that they were working on something special. You sort of kind of get to me. I think
David O. Russell has. I think he works obviously really well with actors. He loves working with multiple actors and, you know, meshing them together. So obviously that's an element, and he shoots fast. Again, we talked about this in what was the last movie?
It was Dallas Buyers Club.
In Dallas Buyers Club, we talked about how beneficial it can be, you know, toward when you can work at the speed of thought. And David O. Russell shoots pretty fast. I mean, that was, with the fighter, the reason why he got the fighter was, you know, they had a director signed on. He's like, okay, I'm going to need just 40 days for the fight scenes alone, like. Dude, the movie's not about fight scenes. And so then David O. Russell understood that. And he's like, I can shoot this in 30 days, including all the fight scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, you got the job.
Yeah. 42 days, apparently, it took to film this.
Yeah.
Which is considering its scope, that's impressive.
Yeah.
Would you? I mean, right? I mean, 42
I would totally, yes.
A month and 2 weeks?
Yeah.
And how many locations they had in this?
Two. They basically shot, they primarily shot in Boston, well, location, but they primarily shot in Boston. And I think he said that they did a couple of scenes in New York. So, I mean, yes, they had, you know, wondering how many sets they may have built wherever. You know, the budget on this movie, production budget is estimated somewhere around $40 million, which...
Actor fees?
Yeah.
Let's see, that would be the biggest, right. It would seem.
Yeah.
And, you know? Yeah, that's a lot.
And I would say, I mean, it hasn't come out yet. But the prints and advertising, I mean, the advertising, maybe it's LA centric, but out here, I saw the advertising everywhere. It almost rivaled Catching Fire, right? Am I wrong? I mean,
I would say I almost, yes, definitely up there.
Rivaled it. I mean, they spent a lot, at least out here. And I don't know if it was LA, New York centric. You know,
for me, this was the most anticipated movie of the year, to be honest. Superman, but that was a letdown.
You know what I want to bring up then? I do want to bring up, I mean, it's no, I'm not hiding the fact that I loved it, but I'm curious. And I think it's important when you discuss movies, like, what were the things that you were disappointed at?
What was I disappointed at? I was disappointed. I didn't think you need the voiceover. I felt it was too much of a crutch. And he's not, you know what I mean? Knowing what he can do, he's built himself up, David O. Russell, to such a high standard. And the way he tells stories, I think it was slightly a rush job, given that, you know, he rewrote the script and things like that. And he just had to get it done. And so he, you know, sometimes as a filmmaker, you reuse techniques that no work.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to that well. Sometimes it's great, but again, just like in storytelling, what's a cliche? A cliche is something that works. Well, the only problem with it is audiences are bored of that and they don't want to see it again. And that's in terms of the con, it wasn't as, you know, the editing was great in terms of pacing of a con movie, especially towards the end, you got to go a little bit faster.
Okay.
Just a little bit. And that wasn't there.
Was that it, or
there was just something intangible that didn't resonate with me that I wish had. And again, it's not the fault of, I think it just came down to a little bit of the script.
Yeah,
a little bit of the script is, you know.
And by a little bit of the script, I ask because I think that. And I want your opinion as well, because I think this is what makes talking about movies, you know, this is what I love about it, mm-hmm. that we can have a different opinion. I think what this show does best and better than anybody else is that we back up what we say, that we have experience in this.
And
we're not just hating to hate, and there's something educated behind it because of our fandom.
True.
So when you say about, like, the script... So what did you think? Like, was it outside of, like, the overvoice? Was it plot points? Was it dialogue?
I think if you had just, you know, I was told too many things, and had you just let it play out, because, you know, we've, like, even in Lock, Stock, and Barrel, and Lock, Stock, it's Barrel, and Two Smoking, what is it?
Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
That's it. you know, we get a voiceover right at the beginning, but then it just, you're in and it plays out. This, it took about, it felt like 15 minutes just to tell the story. I didn't need a huge backstory. They fell in love. They're con artists. Let's go.
Okay.
But it took too long for me to get there. Partly, I also think that this was the first movie out of, if you want to call it the trilogy, that I was eagerly anticipating. The advertising just, you know, Marissa, who's joined us on other shows, Marissa Serafini, to her point, you know, with the trailers initially, she was like, I understand it's a con movie, but I have no idea what it's about. I personally loved those advertisements because I was like, I'm in. It's a con movie. I don't know what the heck's going to happen, but great cast.
Yeah.
Let's do it. And
the music, to your point earlier.
Exactly. Yeah. And whereas the other ones, you know, were kind of recommendations. I wasn't, you know, I was planning on seeing them, but I wasn't as eagerly awaiting them. And so, when the time came, I was like, okay, these are great movies. And you know what? I'm glad I saw it. And I'm glad I saw this one. but it was built up in the biggest way for me, and it's not that it disappointed, but it just didn't fully live up to what it could have. And I think there is a danger to that. You know, sometimes many things can be overhyped, like
absolutely.
Man of Steel.
I mean, absolutely. We never did our Man of Steel thing, and I
because that would be a complete. Why is this movie just terrible?
Okay. But that's okay. We'll get back to Man of Steel. But I mean, you're because you liked it a little bit more.
I said it was a good
movie. But you didn't like
it
as much
as
me.
It's a good movie. It's not a great movie. It has some great acting and some great moments. To me, it definitely slowed down at parts.
Mm-hmm.
Or it did really slow. Also, it's a thought and it comes from just a feeling that you get towards the movie and how absorbed you get. I can get absorbed by a movie very easily. Like, my whole life disappears. Mm-hmm. I'm in the movie and that's all I'm thinking about.
Right.
And then, like, randomly someone will start cracking up and I'll be like, what? There's other people here? That didn't happen to me as much in this movie. I was very aware of everyone around me, of the audience, of how the audience was reacting. I was very aware of, oh, this is Jennifer Lawrence here. Like, let's and maybe that's because at points it got slow, so I got distracted. Another part is because I mentally was thinking, okay, wait, I need to develop my relationship, or I need to really be in love with this storyline, which is the love story.
Sure.
Versus going with one of the other characters, I was like, wait, try and see it more from their perspective, and mm-hmm. you'll get more engaged.
Right.
But I actually had to sit there and go, okay, think about this, it'll bring you more into the movie.
Right.
Instead of it just absorbing you without me
enveloping
trying.
You. Sure.
And like, there are moments that I was like, hilarious, beautifully shot, beautifully done. This is a great spectacle of what's going on.
Sure.
But throughout the movie, I wasn't taken away.
Okay.
I was still like connected to the real world.
Interesting. Okay.
And also, I think timing. Again, it's if literally this wins Best Picture, it's like Argo winning Best. Like, they're to me too similar. I think it's not the movie's fault, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but you're basically a year apart.
Yeah, you are a year apart. They almost had Argo came out in October of 2012, I think, and then this one came out in
December 13th.
Yeah, so
I also think other things should win. More than it should win Best Picture.
Yeah, and
it'll be nominated. It's going to be interesting.
Well, let's talk about that because it's winning awards without people seeing the movie.
Well, this movie and She is another one which, you know, we'll have to talk about at some point. But you're right. I mean, it's winning awards. You know, I mean, you know, the good old screening process and screening it for the HFPA and screening it for various critic organizations, making sure that. I mean, right now we're really on the edge of that. The all and all out publicity blitz for this movie and Dallas Buyers Club and Inside Llewyn Davis and Wolf of Wall Street is going to hit. And then She is already starting to get nominations and wins of stuff. And like, people don't even know what the hell that movie is yet, you know? And, you know, unless you're seeing it at like a Landmark or Sunset, I'm sure is playing the trailer.
The trailer quite a bit.
So, it's just, we're on that onslaught as to what is going to be, you know, Gravity already had, but we're going to see a Gravity swell again. And,
Seen Gravity.
Right.
Some of these movies.
I mean,
some
of them, it'll be a bigger talk about when it does actually come out, and then we can really...
Well, it comes out this weekend, it goes wide. I mean, they did the 6-3, I'm assuming by 6, they meant 3 in Los Angeles and 3 in New York. I don't know quite the breakdown, but it did really well. I mean, thus far, as of today, it's about $850,000 on just 6 screens, 6 locations. That's pretty big. You know, I mean, theaters are selling out.
And it's not playing anymore. Like, it was at the Arclight here, but I think they ended their run. I don't think it's continuing till December 20th.
Which is a couple of days away.
Yeah. Well, they put the pause, give people the anticipation back, and then they'll get the seats filled.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
but they were already getting them filled.
Let's say the awards that it has won. Let's talk about those.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up the Golden Globe.
Okay, let's talk about that one then.
Okay. Because, it's not an award yet. It was a nomination for the Golden Globe. And it got it under the category of Best Comedy Musical. And even David O. Russell has said, you know, Silver Linings Playbook
was way funnier.
But it got drama.
Yeah.
I would say that this movie was more of a musical than a comedy.
I mean, it's funny that you say that because I was like going, are they saying it's a musical because of the great soundtrack?
I would say it's drama, musical, comedy.
What else is in that category where they just try for musicals and comedies?
No, but that's where else we have. That's where else we have. Goodness, what do we? Isn't Nebraska in
Nebraska's under comedy and musical comedy too? Well. I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's look up Golden Globe nominations, shall we?
Basically, we had a bunch of really good dramas, and they decided that we needed to level out some playing field or something.
Yeah, I think that the HFPA was having a hard time. I think they had a lot of movies that they wanted to
nominate.
And they had to be like...
And since they have the People's Choice Awards of categories to go through, I think that they just stuck things into...
Well, it's like if you're taking Captain Phillips and you're putting it definitely next to comedy.
Oh, yeah, it was definitely a knee slapper.
You know, you take Captain Phillips and you put it up against Nebraska and you say, okay, which one's the drama? Everyone's going to say Captain Phillips. You put Captain Phillips in American Hustle, everyone's going to say Captain Phillips. You put American Hustle in Nebraska and you ask people, okay, which one's the comedy and which one's the drama? I think people are going to say, well, they're both dramas.
Okay. Does that make sense? The problem is you're not supposed to compare. It's, right? There's a big argument. A lot of film critics are saying, you know, this movie's it's the most unique movie since blah, blah, blah. Like, right. No. Unique is a state of being. It's either unique or not unique.
Oh, I agree.
Just like a movie.
This is one of Phil's pet peeves.
No, I agree with
him. Just like a movie is a comedy or a drama.
Yeah.
In comparison to Breaking Bad, even though it's a TV show, is this a comedy? Well, yeah. Well, actually, you could argue Breaking Bad is more of a comedy.
Would you say it's comedic?
But then again...
It has comedic elements.
But this is born... The gross squishing together of words. So instead of comedy or a drama, you call it a dramedy.
Yeah.
And it's like, I hate that. Best motion picture musical or comedy. The nominations are American Hustle.
Give me a drum roll on the last one.
Inside Llewyn Davis, Nebraska, and
Reza. Drum roll.
I'm looking at the Golden Globe.
Why are you like, do your job?
Are we still waiting? It is The Wolf of Wall Street.
Oh.
Thank you.
It's a little bit late on that. All right. Timing is not so great.
We'll work on it.
I'm switching back here.
It's all good.
There's a lot of buttons.
So, and again, I haven't seen Wolf of Wall Street. I'm seeing the trailers. And I'm seeing the trailers for Wolf of Wall Street, and I'm like going...
That looks like a comedy.
It could be a comedy, but you know, I look at Anchorman 2 as a comedy, and I'm not saying you know I can look
at the World's End as a comedy.
The World's End is a comedy, you know. I would even, to an extent, say The Way Way Back. I could say is comedy. It's weird because let's look at what they have for drama. What they chose is drama. We have 12 Years a Slave. That movie. I don't think there's any.
The musical. Yeah. How many songs are sung in that?
Oh, that's true.
Ron Blank Run. I mean, that's a musical. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my God. This is such a level.
Where did we just go? That's awful.
Oh, my God.
Captain Phillips. I mean, you know, Gravity? Okay. Philomena is definitely a drama.
Okay.
And Rush, which we talked about here and liked a lot too. I think that's definitely a drama. But it's really weird. I mean, we liked Rush a lot. When Rush got nominated here, I'll be honest, as much as I liked Rush, I was a little bit surprised that it got in there. But they're saying because it's the Hollywood foreign press that they have more akin to the story to Rush than we would here as Americans. And they're saying they gave it to him because, you know, they're at the Hollywood Foreign Press. They understand the Formula One racing. I don't know. It was weird.
I mean, I do. To me, it does stick out a little bit in the nominations. But I really loved Rush.
Yeah.
And it's like when I look at what I'm going to buy, not that what I want to buy should win. I'm like, I really want to see Rush again. I will watch that movie multiple mm-hmm. times.
It was a good movie.
And I don't know. It's like part of me is kind of happy that it made it into that list, even though it does stick out as something different compared to the rest.
I'm glad. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm glad that it got recognition because we here certainly recognize that movie as being a very good movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sort of kind of lends credence to what we say, what we're talking about. We do try. But again, I just think that it's really weird that both American Hustle, I was like, I didn't know that was a comedy and or a musical. Her, I haven't seen, but the trailers don't look like it's a knee slapper. Inside Llewyn Davis, yes, they can say it's a musical, but it's definitely not a comedy.
It's about music.
I think that American Hustle and Inside Llewyn Davis are just in the musical category, and they just don't know.
Perhaps. Yeah. But what about Nebraska? I mean, I don't say that that is...
I don't know.
...very much a comedy.
That one I really can't figure out for you.
Well, yeah. I think they're going to pick up a lot of... I think in terms of acting, a lot of nominations headed their way, you know?
Yeah, I think
And they've already won. So, I mean, Jennifer Lawrence is being honored for various things already. Let me just double check the facts on what she's winning.
What'd she win?
Keep talking and I'll tell you.
Did she get the national broadcast NBA or NB... NBR...
Let me bring up
the
whole...
Do I need to be Googling this right now?
I'm going to Google it. You guys talk about...
But Jennifer Lawrence did get nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress for this movie.
For this movie, yeah.
There you go.
Who's she up against?
She's up against Sally Hawkins from Blue Jasmine, Lupita Nyong'o
from 12 Years.
12 Years Slave, Julia Roberts from August 06.
Oh, talk about the controversy.
About
Jennifer Lawrence and Julia Roberts? You guys know that one?
No.
What?
Go for it.
Okay. Thank God I listened to Ryan Seacrest in the morning.
Hence why
I'm listening to Howard Stern, so I may have missed it. But what happened?
Okay, so apparently a statement was made by Jennifer, something... Oh, I'm going to butcher this, but something that, you know, Julia Roberts isn't necessarily America's sweetheart or something like that. And Julia Roberts responded something like, Jennifer Lawrence definitely... They have some... Julia Roberts now apparently has beef with Jennifer Lawrence.
Why?
Over being America's sweetheart.
What are you talking about?
The title
I'm so
of
a, confused.
Okay, over Twitter... this was over Twitter.
It was over Twitter? Okay.
Do I need to be Googling this?
Yes. Look up the feud between... Because I don't want to get the facts wrong. But it's over the title
because
of...
from how you just described that, that makes no sense.
I know. But, where it's left off, Jennifer Lawrence stated that she has no problems with Julia Roberts. She has no problem with Julia Roberts having the title of America's Sweetheart. She doesn't even want to be America's Sweetheart. She respects her and things like that. But right. It just got... And especially on Twitter, so many people can respond and things like that. It just blew out of proportion.
Crazy.
Because, you know, they're in the same... category.
You know, while she's looking that up, let's go back to our, you know, to American Hustle. I said that I was going to put I Heart Huckabees.
Yes.
You had made a comment earlier on about how David O. Russell works well with actors, where, you know, to me, I Heart Huckabees had so much friction on set. Lily Tomlin, in fact, can YouTube the stuff where she dresses him down like crazy on set. It was captured on video. It's been released. You can YouTube it. And, you know, it's really interesting to me is that he was able to, I mean, the movie was a disaster, outside of the fact that it had all that controversy while filming and Lily Tomlin's outburst, that David O. Russell was able to come back. And get to do The Fighter And then, you know, and how much he changed as a director. Apparently he's changed because these people like working with him. The other thing I thought was sort of kind of neat about American Hustle and about this trilogy is the fact that, do you realize that he wrote Silver Linings Playbook first? Or he adapted it, I should say.
Yes.
He did that first, couldn't get, you know, couldn't get it off the ground, and he ended up doing, you know, he was offered The Fighter. So I think that's a cool, you know, story. And because of the success of The Fighter, he was able to do Silver Linings. So that's interesting. Did you find it? I see that you have Twitter up.
So supposedly, this article that I'm reading right now doesn't buy it either. There was some comment made by Julia Roberts that went along the lines of, this is about Jennifer Lawrence. I think she's fabulous, but she doesn't seem ... She seems cooler than ... So basically the essence of it was that's what's being made of. She seems like too cool to be America's
too cool for
sweetheart.
School.
But I, from the way I'm reading it, I think people are blowing it out of proportion.
So
and
blowing
there's
it out
no,
of proportion.
There's no context of like anger or jealousy over the title America's Sweetheart. I think it was just casual conversation that people then are like, wait, let's
just look
take
at
out these two
Twitter's
words
dangerous.
It-
That's
check
the bottom
out,
line.
Check out this video. Go back to the moment when I announced there's beef between Julia Roberts and Jennifer Lawrence and look at your guys' reaction like, tell me more. You know, it's,
yeah,
you guys were in shock. B, tell me more.
Yeah,
that's
I was like,
because
what?
They seem like such nice people. And yeah. I'm like, there really can't be. They're too nice.
Who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, in their own right, yeah, who cares?
And I think that they both are kind of America's sweethearts over time. So there you go.
Listen, they both had their day in the sun. You know, and right now it's Jennifer Lawrence. I mean, Jennifer Lawrence is the flavor of the month. The only thing, you know, right now is it... Do you say that it's too much, Jennifer Lawrence? I mean, because an audience can turn on you. And I think Jennifer Lawrence is smart enough. And I think the people that she associates herself with are also smart enough that whatever her next role is, or maybe she'll take time off, but I know
she's
doing the next
smart.
Catching
I think
fire.
She was very smart about her career. I would say the same as Julia Roberts. She's always been pretty smart. She's been around for a really long time. She did a ton of movies in one period. I would say the same with, like, Kate Winslet earned her fame pretty early and was, like, the starlet and also controlled her career very well.
Yeah.
I would say Jennifer Lawrence is on a very good foot. And although she is very prevalent and, like, the intention's all on her, I don't think...
Let me ask you
I don't
this.
Think it's just a blip.
Okay, so Christian Bale, he's also in From the Furnace.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know...
out of the furnace, or
out of the furnace,
into the furnace, out of it.
So, how do you compare him to the, you know? I haven't seen that yet, so I can't compare. Like, you know, it becomes tough when an actor has the same movies coming out so close. How do you
Absolutely.
Compare him versus this?
Well, look at
with Jennifer
Tom Hanks.
Yeah,
it has Saving Mr. Banks and Captain Phillips.
Yeah,
and Jennifer Lawrence. You were going to say what? Catching Fire? Or?
No, I was going to. Well, Catching Fire, obviously, but in terms of awards, okay, she just won an Oscar last year,
right? Mm-hmm.
Is this performance, first off, as a supporting actress, she's not, yes, she does a great job. Is she on screen enough to be a supporting actress? You know, I mean, obviously supporting them, you know what I mean? But there's people who are on screen more that I think should and deserve it.
I think that this, I don't know if I'm answering your question, because I think there's three ways you have to look at it. One, to be nominated for a movie, I think you have to deserve it from that movie. Like, have enough screen time or make a big enough impact in the plot or be a big enough device or whatever to be nominated. And then I think you compare who's in the categories to win by year. I don't like it when people compare a supporting actress from this year to a supporting actress 3 years ago because it's a different year. It's a different set of awards. We're not... you can't do that. The same thing, if she won last year, I don't think you should really compare her acting that role compared to what it is now. I don't think that's fair. I think you have to separate it by years. I think you have to go down to the movie, from the movie to who else is in the category.
But it's the same as if let's say I won an award and everyone said like, oh, you only won it because of your body of work, not really for that movie. And
that happens all the time.
And I'd be like, good. That means my body of work is so good that I just had to get an award.
That's not what that award is. That's what lifetime achievements are for.
No, but yeah, to Phil's point, unfortunately. Well, first thing, let's talk Jennifer Lawrence, I think she would fall under best supporting. She falls under the Judi Dench clause, so to speak. You know, personally, I thought that her presence in the movie, while she may not have had the same screen time as, say, Amy Adams, her presence was ever felt throughout a lot of that movie. In various scenes that we talked about here, whether it's singing Live and Let Die, or whether it's the scene with the microwave, or the scene at the casino with the mobsters, I think her presence was great and felt throughout. I agree with your point 100% in that, yeah, I do believe that, you know, it should be nominated for that year. But then, you know, to Phil's point, the Academy Award has a history of doing things like that. Like, for example, Russell Crowe's a great example. He won for Gladiator. I'm not taking anything away from Gladiator. It was fantastic. But the year before, I believe he was up for like Inside Man. And they didn't give it to the, so it's almost like sometimes people say, well, he got this award because of his performance there. And they do it for movies all the time, like Lord of the Rings.
And it's annoying, but it creates a cycle. It's like, oh, but we had to give it to this person when we should have given it to that person. So now in 3 years, when he's up for something else, we're going to give it to them, even though this person, like,
it's a body politic. It's a body politic that votes.
Then have a 10-year special of the Academy Awards where you have the all-stars.
Well, I can go into what I feel that the Academy should do, you know, to garner fresh blood. But here's the thing. I mean, when we look at The Return of the King, mm-hmm. okay, that won Best Picture.
That won 11.
And here's the deal. It didn't win it for Return of the King. It won it for the entire trilogy because each of those movies were nominated for Best Picture. In every year that those movies, like the Fellowship, Two Towers, Return of the King, he didn't get it for anything. And it was almost like, well, he made this great body of work. We're going to give it to him for Return of the King. And unfortunately, you know, and I do. I mean, I agree with you. It should go the year, but I think the voting mentality, you know, it's almost like, well, you know, people are saying, and we felt he maybe should have won it for this one. So this was a very good performance, but we'll give it to him for this one. I mean, Scorsese, how long did it take for Scorsese to win an Academy Award?
True that.
Right? So, you know.
And it's like, I don't know. I just think that come up with another solution instead of not giving it to the deserving people of that year. Do something so you can honor people for their bodies of work, so you can acknowledge them. Because people are aware of the fact that it was so good. And I'm not saying that they don't deserve recognition. I'm just saying it's an award show that happens every year. Base it on the year's work.
Let's bring home with American Hustle. I know you guys talked about, I think it was a movie that I wasn't here for. I think it was Nebraska, where you guys talked about, you know, how no matter what, you guys can watch it in any period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a movie that will be revisited? I believe so.
For me, yes. I mean, I will. What I'm hoping for, although this is I forget who released his previous movies, like The Fighter and Silver Linings, but it would be great if, you know, since he is calling it a trilogy, if there was a way to box up these three movies.
I think
American Hustle. If it's a box set, I'll buy it.
But, however, the only thing is if another studio, I'm not sure Sony released The Fighter, and I'm not sure, I forget who released Silver Linings. If they're different studios, I don't think that'll happen just because of.
I think it was Weinstein who did
The Fighter?
Perhaps.
Yeah. So
I think Weinstein might have done both.
Yeah. So, but in any case, you know, for me, yes. I mean, I'll be able to watch this movie. I think it'll be remembered for its performances, and such. And I think thematically, and again, because you're setting it into the 70s, you're already setting it into it already in a sense, because they did it respectfully. It makes it, you can watch it at any time and not have it feel like it's dated, because it already is in a sense dated. It's like watching, I'm not comparing it to The Godfather, but you can go back and watch The Godfather, even though it takes place at a certain time period. You can continue to watch it because it has a good story, and it's already, in a sense, it's dated. So, and I think American Hustle does the same thing. I mean,
the logos, right? The logos were done in a way that was from the old one, right?
What are you talking, like, when
I think that was in... Braska.
Was that Dials? No, right? The logos.
I know what you're saying, and I don't think that's for this film. I think that was for another film we did.
We watched way too many movies.
No. I think you're talking about the way Annapurna came on.
Yes.
Was very that shadowy, very 70s-ish. Yeah.
Don't say I'm wrong, sir.
I'm talking about one of the movies we covered recently. The actual, I think it was the Paramount logo or something on one of them, was the actual version from, I think it might have been Dallas Buyers Club, where it was the actual logo that was in circulation during that period.
Annapurna, that logo had that shadow effect that came out. Yeah.
Okay.
Don't say I'm wrong.
I was just clarifying.
I was correct.
I was clarifying.
And in Argo, it's funny because Argo used the old Warner Brothers logo.
That's more, you know, for that,
absolutely.
And I like that. I think it's fun.
I like when they do that too.
It's like trivia.
Yeah.
Yes. <It's> like trivia. How did the Warner Brothers logo look like that?
Yes, I think we're getting so off topic and so out of hand.
No, but I do think it's legacy. Look, it's we know. Do we agree that it's going to get nominations? A lot.
Absolutely.
Right? Yes. I think? Yeah.
I mean, it's going to.
Yeah. And I think it'll be under Best Picture, not Best Comedy and or Musical.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see musical. Audience reaction. You know, we're talking about this now, but we've seen it, but it's nominated.
The audience, I think, is going to love it. Yeah. I think the audience is going to love it.
Hey, we did talk
about it. But it's a very specific type of audience. I think
it'll be an It movie. Well, you know, when talking about the music, anybody know that Danny Elfman did the score? I didn't even notice there was score, but Danny Elfman worked on this movie.
Danny Elfman, you're back.
Easy job for him. What do you need me to write? What do you need me to do?
Seconds
of music, great, done.
Good.
I'll do it tomorrow.
Simple. It's crazy because you had Danny Elfman did score, but the Susan Jacobs, have to give her a lot of credit because she helped put together the soundtrack and getting the licenses.
Oh,
so.
She did great.
She's fantastic. So, come on, iTunes. Give us a double album.
All right, guys. Thank you guys for joining us yet again for another Anatomy of a Movie. Dimitri, where can they find you?
They can find me here at Anatomy of a Movie. Go onto YouTube, go onto iTunes, go into anatomyofamovie.com. Leave your comments. You know, I just noticed, hey, guys, we've hit sort of kind of a milestone. 1,700 views for Catching Fire.
That's because we're catching fire.
That's fantastic. And why are there only one comment? People, if you're watching us, comment. Tell us. Let us know what you think.
Scared. Or, at this point in time, the new YouTube comment system is just confusing everybody, unfortunately. It really is. Sarah Stratton.
Hi.
Find her in a movie is coming soon. Because she is a great actress. And, of course, follow us at Movie Anatomy. On Twitter, anatomyofmovie.com, facebook.com/anatomyofmovie. We'll see you here for The Hobbit. We've got Lone Survivor coming up. We've got Saving Mr. Banks, Wolf of Wall Street, and a slew of others coming up in 2014.
And we got to be doing our top tens, right? And we have to be talking about nominations.
We got so much things.
All right, we got to reel it in. Sorry.
And that'll be next episode. See you guys then.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.
Thanks for watching Anatomy of a Movie on YouTube. For more on your favorite movies, subscribe to our channel here, and be sure to let us know what you think in our comment section below here. Bye.